Hello, welcome to J Talks Live. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, host of the CBC podcast More and host of this webcast series. My guest today is Ian Hanemansing, who is based in Vancouver as host for CBC's The National. As you may recall, British Columbia had the first reported cases of community transmission in the country, and its handling of this pandemic has been intriguing to watch. And we're going to get to more of that in just a moment. First, the Canadian Journalism Foundation would like to thank the generosity of J Talks sponsor, BMO Financial Group, and the in-kind support of Cision. For those of you joining us for the first time, we've got some helpful notes for you on this webcast. If your internet quality is poor, you can click on the little thing that says click here to switch stream, and you can view it at a lower bandwidth. The video quality will decrease. The audio, however, will remain the same. If you are having any technical issues, you can click on request help. It's in a bubble in the top right corner of the webcast page, and your help request will be emailed back to you at the email address you've provided to join us. The webcast will be 40 minutes long. I will chat with Ian first before taking your questions. I already have some waiting, feel free to submit your questions as we go. Just use the questions tab. And if you want to tweet about this, you can tweet it. The hashtag is JTalksLive. So let's join Ian Hanemansing. He is in Vancouver. He is the weekend host of CBC News' The National. We'll be discussing the regional differences in the handling of COVID-19. And Ian will tell us what it's like for journalists reporting on this new reality. Hello, Ian. Thanks for joining.
Very happy to be here. How are you?
I'm well, and touch wood or something, you know, because at this time with this kind of stuff, you just don't want to get COVID, right? You've been reporting, and I have for a long time. You started your career, as I did, in Atlantic Canada, and there have been many big stories as you moved around and across the country, but this one seems in a league of its own, Ian. Like, it's an intersection of health and medicine and politics and economics and geopolitics, and I'm interested to know your perspective as you watch this unfold and cover it every day.
Yeah, I wonder if people are tired of hearing the word unprecedented to describe the times we're living in right now. But yeah, you and I have been in this business for roughly the same amount of time. And I've given this a lot of thought, especially in the last few days. And I can't remember any story that has come close to COVID-19 in terms of like any way you'd measure a story. You know, September 11th at the time, I think, for people of our generation was described in those terms. And it seemed that way. And I remember on The National, about a week or 10 days after September 11th, someone did a story on all the major events that had been missed by the news because of September 11th. Well, with COVID-19, from I guess it was around March 16th when things really started moving quickly, maybe even a week before that, we went weeks and weeks and weeks where not only the lead story every night on every newscast was COVID-19, but every story on every newscast was COVID-19. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, we said to ourselves, okay, there must be stuff going on out there that we're missing that we need to get into the newscast. And every once in a while, there was a small story. But until that terrible tragedy in Nova Scotia, there was no major story and there was no other lead story. And even a few days after the worst mass shooting in Canada, in Nova Scotia, even a few days after that, that had receded from the first block of a lot of newscasts. And guess what replaced it again was COVID-19.
No, it's really interesting because the stories that stemmed, like the stories in other areas, still have those tentacles that are connected to COVID-19 as well. And as you say, but it's also a story led by science and medicine.
Yeah.
We haven't seen.
Yeah, and many of us have talked about that. I have never seen scientists, and doctors, of course, are among them. There certainly are scientists who have been so much front and center, have been so celebrated in this country, at least, for the most part, and there have been some exceptions, but overwhelmingly, their credentials have not been questioned. And it's been particularly interesting in British Columbia, Anna Maria, right? Because here we have Dr. Bonnie Henry, who's taken on this incredible role. Like I was at a supermarket yesterday, and there's a sign on the plexiglass shield between the clerk and the customer, and it says, Dr. Bonnie Henry says that we can't use reusable bags or something like that. But the point was, it wasn't BC Health. It wasn't the government has said. It wasn't due to COVID-19 concerns. It was Dr. Bonnie Henry says we can't do this. And she has taken on this spotlight. She's in the spotlight in British Columbia that is incredible. And so, for example, people across the country should think about this for a moment, that when we have our daily briefing here at 3 o'clock Pacific time each afternoon, which has become must-see television for a lot of people. Like, I know people who will make a point of saying, hey, you know what? I got to go in front of the TV or listen to the radio because Dr. Henry's about to give her briefing. It's the health minister, not the premier in British Columbia, who introduces her, does it very briefly, and then she is the person who answers most of the questions in that briefing and does most of the talking. And it just speaks to the role that she has in this province and the influence she has. But, you know, that influence doesn't come because of a bully pulpit, right? It comes after all these weeks because people feel she has credibility, and that credibility comes with making good decisions and presenting it in a good way. And I don't think this is an inappropriate comment for a journalist to make to pass judgment on this, because I will. Like, she has done a fantastic job, and people in this province really respect her.
It is really interesting how the politicians, the premier and the health minister, cede to her in a way that is far greater than anywhere else in the country.
Yeah. And you don't hear them say, I can remember a premier in another province introducing I'm trying not to use genders because I don't want to identify them in this, their health officer, and saying, you know, we're going to give the health officer a chance to speak now. You never hear that rhetoric in British Columbia. But I have to say, it's not just, I think the government here does deserve some credit for ceding that role to her. But I also think that she has, her consistent way of dealing with things. I've never seen her get exasperated in a news conference. I've never seen her angry. And I've also always seen her driven by data and optimism. So let me give you an example of how it's driven by data. Just before the long Easter weekend, there was a story that started emerging on the Thursday before Good Friday. People on the Gulf Islands were worried because they saw huge, what they thought were huge lineups of people getting onto the ferries to go to the Gulf Islands or the Sunshine Coast, or sort of our version of cottage country. And so stories were done in the media about this terrible phenomenon. You weren't supposed to be traveling. You're supposed to be staying home. Don't overwhelm these places that have small hospitals. Bonnie Henry was asked about that on Good Friday, I think it was, or maybe the Saturday. Anyway, what did she do? She went to the data, even on something like this. This wasn't a health question, but it was how many people were actually getting on the ferry. So she talked to BC Ferries and found out that there were fewer sailings. There were fewer people allowed on each ferry. I think I'm right with this. Far fewer people were traveling. And of those people who were traveling, she pointed out, many of them probably had good reasons to go there. They might be commuting. They might have an elderly relative who needed a visit. And it was just kind of talking down all the outrage in the province. And that has been her approach consistently. And I think people have responded to that.
It's interesting. She has more robust powers. Andre Picard, when he was a part of the JTalk Lives, one of our earlier discussions, made the point that her power is far more robust than most medical officers of health. But it's also the idea that when she says something, people believe they should listen. And so what we've seen in BC, we're now seeing an easing of some restrictions in BC. Maybe first of all, give us a little bit of an idea of what's changing.
Well, I think something even a lot of people in British Columbia didn't realize, and this was pointed out in some of the briefings about 2 weeks ago, far fewer things were ordered closed in British Columbia than in other parts of the country. And so, for example, I remember seeing somebody on Twitter saying, how come the craft store, Michael's, is open, and that's certainly not an essential service? Well, stores were allowed to stay open in the province. And so supermarkets, of course, drug stores, of course, although in British Columbia, we have a chain here, London Drugs, which is kind of a quasi-department store. So you could buy big screen TVs at London Drugs throughout the pandemic. But craft stores were open. Some bookstores were open. So we never had the kind of shutdown that other provinces did. And to the extent that stores did close, if you walk down Robson Street, for example, one of the major shopping streets in downtown Vancouver, most stores were closed, but they were closed voluntarily. Definitely restaurants were not allowed to have in-store dining. Barbershops were ordered closed, and hairstylists. So we had fewer closures, and now we are in the process of this phased reopening like we've seen in other parts of the country. But something I think we'll talk more about in a moment, but I'll just quickly touch on it. I love the fact that this story has reminded us of how geographically big this country is, how regions respond to things differently. And a province that both you and I worked in a long, long time ago, the province I grew up in, New Brunswick, the three biggest malls in New Brunswick, for example, opened up yesterday. Like, how dramatically different is that from the situation in most of the rest of Canada, right? It's a reminder. This is a big country in this story, even though the infection, the virus is exactly the same and is equally infectious from coast to coast to coast, the impact has been different.
Well, let's keep talking about that now instead of picking up on it later, because we do live in a country that's very long. What was that line that Arthur Black used to say? We're like weather stripping along the U.S. border. but it is very different. And talk to me a little bit more, because you are in Vancouver. You're not only yet, like, you're anchoring the news. You're part of the discussions on what covers the news. It's really important to have you there, as opposed to having everyone at Toronto headquarters. Yeah. But what kinds of things are you seeing that you're reminded about this, like the need for that kind of diligence when we live in such a huge country?
Yeah, so I'm in the newsroom right now, as people can probably tell, but I've been doing a lot of my work from home, as many people are. And especially, I would say, early on in the pandemic, mid-March, early April, when things were shut down, when there was a high level of anxiety in many places in the country, I would be on conference calls with most, like our editorial staff, most of whom are in Toronto for the National. And I would hear about how things are shut down, and I could sense a certain level of anxiety. And I was sitting on my couch, and I happened to live across from a city park, and I could see out the window, and there were people jogging, and there were people sitting in the park, and everything seemed so different from what I was hearing on the conference call. And so part of that is, I think, a general reminder in journalism that and I think for consumers of journalism that real, even when we report on things accurately, let's say like murders, for example, that doesn't mean that, you know, murders are happening everywhere, but they're happening in some places and they're important to cover, but it doesn't reflect reality on every street corner. But the other thing we need to remember is that sometimes, and this is where I think COVID is different than, let's say, crime reporting, sometimes things are unfolding dramatically differently from place to place. So where the Nova Scotia premier was saying, stay the blazes home, and where I could see the mayor of Toronto saying to people, look, you know, don't go into parks, they're shut down, and don't leave the house unless you have to. Again, Bonnie Henry in Vancouver was talking about her morning runs. Like, she was going out for morning runs. She was encouraging people to exercise outside, but maintain their distance. And so what I was seeing out my window, literally, was so different from what I was hearing on that conference call. And I remember one weekend in particular, think back to Friday, March the 13th. That was the time when the NHL had just shut down, NBA had shut down, and we were really starting to understand that this pandemic had become much bigger than we had thought even a week before. That weekend in British Columbia, restaurants were still open. And the guidance here was, it was still okay to go to a restaurant, just be careful when you're there. But the Ottawa City health officer that weekend had told people not to leave their homes. And I remember on the National, a reporter here in Vancouver and I wanted to show some pictures on the Sunday of how many people were out and about in Vancouver. And some people in Toronto said, well, that's kind of irresponsible. It wasn't irresponsible, right? It was what was happening here, and it had the blessing of the health officials here. It was just things were different here. And so it's just a reminder. And look, I mean, I'm in Vancouver. I don't know what's happening in Kamloops, British Columbia. I don't know what's happening in Kenora. And it's just a reminder for all of us that I don't care what organization it is, there's always a concentration of decision makers in one place, whether it's Vancouver or Toronto or Ottawa. And we just need to remember that we need to bring people into that circle who are can reflect for us what's happening in different places. You know, we talk about diversity a lot in journalism, and we've learned, Anna Maria, you and I have seen the changes in the last 10 years as opposed to 30 years in terms of ethnic diversity and gender balance, and all of those things have changed the way to the good of how we've reflected and covered stories. But I think COVID reminds us that regional diversity is really important too. And by that, I don't mean a token story from the West. I mean, making sure that people who are helping you make decisions reflect what's happening in their part of the country, or even within a region, what's happening in Northern BC, as opposed to Kamloops, as opposed to Vancouver.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit more, because you are at the table as you discuss, like we've seen the national shift with, you know, where you are, what's going on in Toronto with reporters. We see the, you know, the long poles with the microphone on the end, like people doing their best to, or people doing, you know, web interviews. I'm wondering how you think this will affect news gathering and journalism going forward.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think technically it's had a huge impact on how we do the news, and all of a sudden out of necessity, and I think this is true in a whole bunch of sectors, right? But out of necessity, we're tolerating Skype and FaceTime and Zoom interviews in a way we didn't before. You know, a year and a half ago on the National, I remember one of our senior producers was exasperated when she would see a Skype interview. She didn't feel that it was fitting for the National to do that. And so we would spend a lot of time and effort to get a camera out to Brampton, let's say, to have the person with, you know, high def camera quality as opposed to low def Skype quality. All of a sudden we're tolerating that. And will that mean that a year from now, there'll be less of a push to head out to Brampton to get that interview in person? There could be a backlash too. People could be tired of the bad quality and bad angles and bad lighting. But let's say that does happen. And then think about somebody like yourself, Anna Maria, who, and there's so many people, like, we know if you've been in the field, there, like, some part of being in the field doing reporting is wasted time, right? Like sometimes if you spend an hour and a half to drive somewhere to interview somebody for half an hour and then come back, maybe there's a more efficient way to do that. But how many times have we seen in our lives as reporters that there are things that, you know, speaking of regional diversity, there are things that you don't feel, understand, or see until you're right there, looking the person in the eyes, seeing what it's like in his or her neighborhood. So if we are more tolerant of Skype interviews instead of being there in person, will we gain in terms of efficiency? Will we lose in terms of having journalists out in the field? Because yeah, there's something to be said about that long drive and getting into a place and seeing firsthand the context of the person who's talking.
Oh, for sure. And seeing what else is around and how that can, you know, I used to always tell journalists coming up, you get ready, no matter how much you think you know what you're going to cover, when you get there, it could take a turn that you don't even know. Because you just don't know, like, until you don't know till you know. But for sure, one of the other things that I think that has come out of the reporting, I saw it on the National last night, I was reading it in the Globe and Mail, other print and radio, is the connection of some things, the connection of domestic violence to the people staying at home, to the, like, some of the really terrifying consequences of this pandemic beyond the straight medical diagnosis, has been good to see that journalists are paying attention to those stories as well, in a way where I'm not convinced that would have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I mean, you know as well as I do how things have changed, and it does speak to like changing frames, changing outlooks in newsrooms, and I mean, and part of it does come to who the decision makers are in newsrooms and how different people see different stories differently, right? And there was a sameness to the newsrooms we walked into 30 years ago. Was it 30 years ago? I guess maybe it might have been.
That was a while.
Anyway, there was the sameness, right? And we all bring our lives into decision making, and we were talking about this before, like a little earlier this morning. One of the things I think is interesting in the COVID coverage is how I see people's personality sometimes reflected, maybe not in the stories, but certainly in the conversations we have in the newsrooms. If you're an anxious person who I think that's exacerbated by the COVID situation. If you're an optimistic person, I think that is reflected sometimes in news judgments. And so I think this always happens in journalism, but I'm seeing it especially with the COVID story, maybe because the COVID story affects everything, right? It affects our livelihood. It affects where we're spending time. It is by extension affecting our relationship with the family members we have in our homes and the family members that we can't hug because they don't live in our homes. Never again, this unprecedented word, right? Never before have we seen a story that's affected everybody in every area of their life. From exercising to not watching hockey to my connection to my parents in New Brunswick, never have I seen a story that has affected everything.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking behind you. How often are you in the studios and in the newsroom?
Yeah, my wife asked me yesterday, am I even allowed to be here? And I'm not sure, because I think in her work at a law firm, they've been told not to go into their office. So the Vancouver newsroom is kind of that way. I'm on one edge of it. And literally, you know what? I can't see a single person from where I'm sitting. And normally there might be about 50 people sitting there. So all of our radio shows obviously are still on. The local TV news is still on. The national has a small staff here. And so most people here are working from home. I came in because my internet connection at home wasn't up to snuff. So I was told to come in and do it here. But yeah, it's been different. I do come in here on Fridays and Sundays to do the national with one camera operator, and we have no problem distancing. And I have to say, I like coming in. I like the act of leaving the house and coming into the newsroom and sitting at my desk with the computer. And yesterday I came in here just because there were a couple of things I needed to do, and ended up having an impromptu conversation with a producer who happened to be here yesterday too, and she normally isn't. And I thought, I don't care how efficient Zoom is, there's something to be said about personal contact, even 2 meters away. And the impromptu conversation we had, we ended up coming up with, I think, some good ideas about some COVID stories and the reopening of retail. And I don't think we would have had that if we hadn't seen each other face to face. So I, for one, am enjoying a little bit of face to face and hoping that at some point we repopulate the newsroom.
And it's something to think about, that camaraderie and that sharing of ideas in office spaces, because we know it's not going to go back to the way it used to be. And we just don't know quite what it'll look like. I want to start asking you some of the questions, because we got a lot of questions from people writing in, and I'm not necessarily in a particular order, but this one fits into specifically what we were talking about Dr. Henry. It would appear, this comes from Patricia Frankie Deverell. It would appear, despite or perhaps because of the scope of the Lynn Valley deaths, that BC, aka Dr. Bonnie Henry, got way out in front of the decimation of long-term care homes that Ontario and Quebec have experienced. To what strategies, measures do you attribute this comparative success?
So I've been following the COVID story here really closely in Vancouver, in British Columbia. And so some of the things I know very well, this one I know less well, but I do feel that the question is, as far as I know, completely on point, that terrible outbreak in the North Shore was just that, terrible, large tragic loss of life. But I think it did force British Columbia to focus on that outbreak very quickly. And one of the things, famously, I guess, that British Columbia did was brought in rules that couldn't be implemented overnight because it's complicated, but brought in rules, I believe this is true, that prevented care workers from going from home to home to home. A lot of them do that for various reasons. One is to get enough hours to make ends meet, but BC shut that down, and I think that did help with reducing the spread. But we'd certainly had other outbreaks at other long-term care centers after that. And also, I think it probably sharpened the focus of British Columbia in terms of redoubling infection control in those homes, right? And so on, a little bit out of an area that I've studied closely here in British Columbia, but I think the question is right. And if you ask Monty Henry about why the infection rates here appear to be lower, and I say appear because part of it has to do with testing, certainly the number of people in intensive care and number of deaths is lower here comparatively than most other places. She'll cite two things, and I think there's the third thing that she is uncomfortable of citing. First one is they really benefited from the experience of other parts of the country. Quebec in particular, they talk about how they got guidance from Quebec. March break or spring break happened earlier in Quebec, and they were told, listen, that is a huge potential spreader of COVID, people coming back into the country. And so here, schools were closed so that when March break ended, people didn't go back into schools, right? So that was timing that way was one of those things. Secondly, she talks about luck. And I think luck does play a role sometimes in how infection control plays out. But the third thing I think is a lot of smart decisions here. And there wasn't an overreaction in terms of shutting things down. But at the same time, when it did come time to shut schools down or to stop having sporting events, they were willing to take bold action. And one other thing I remember is that around the middle of March, when the border was still open, British Columbia spoke like very strongly. The provincial government said that border to the United States should be closed, even when the federal government hadn't done that. And two or three days later, the federal government did comply.
Got a question from David Gorman. There are fire hoses of information coming at us every day. How do you distill it all into short sound bites? How do you determine what we viewers really need to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's come out of this is that there are fewer short sound bites, right? That more than ever, we are spending more time on these stories. So first of all, the daily briefings, like CBC News Network and CTV News Channel as well, have been fantastic at showing these daily briefings across the country. And I've been just, you know, consuming them all. And I think you look at the ratings for all broadcasters in Canada are way up. And so you can just sit there and from your couch monitor these briefings right across the country and hear the unvarnished process of news gathering, hear the questions. And I've seen people complain about reporters' questions, and I think, you know what, these are scrums. Like when you're asking those questions, it's not like you, Anna Maria, with carefully crafted questions on a podcast or a radio show. When you're in a news conference, you're throwing questions out because all you care about is the answers you're getting back, and it's kind of disjointed and it's messy, but that's what a news conference is like. So people get to see that. And then think of the National, right? Where every night we've had a panel, almost always with doctors, occasionally financial experts or other areas, having time to answer questions. And so fewer sound bites, I think, than before. More time on the newscast to deal with these stories. But yeah, there's always we are a filter, right? It's always a question of sitting down there and saying, what are the stories of people? What stories do we think people need to know tonight? And that has always been the process of news gathering and making newscasts.
Ian, we were talking earlier about the fact that like you have really noticed like the viewership up around everybody, but also Canadians viewing CNN. What have you seen?
I'm fascinated by this. So CNN's numbers are astonishing at night, particularly around 9 and 10 o'clock Eastern time. It's been consistent. The numbers, you know, the total numbers of people watching Canadian television news dwarfs the people watching CNN. But still, if you look just at news channels, CNN is doing incredibly well. And the way that news ratings are calculated is it's based on the number of people watching in the hour. So if you have 300,000 or 400,000 people watching CNN at 9 o'clock, that's more than 300,000 or 400,000 people, because some of those people only watched for maybe 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. So they're probably like there are hundreds of thousands of Canadians who are spending significant time watching CNN. Why? What is it that draws?
I think it's the hunger, right? That's the hunger for information. We have this giant over the border, as you just said, that, you know, medical officer of health saying, be careful with the border. And, you know, let's face it, you know, I don't think we've ever seen a leader of the free world tell us to use disinfectant to cure ourselves.
Well, so yes.
I mean, like some of it is you've got to see what's going on there.
Yeah, no, listen, I did.
Full disclosure, I watched too.
Yeah. And it doesn't make you a bad person or any of those people bad people. This is the nice thing about media, right? You get to make your choices and consume what you want. Also, like you have an anchor, a telegenic anchor who had COVID and who took us through that journey, and we and whose brother is the governor of New York, who's also telegenic and combative and interesting. It's very easy to watch CNN. Sometimes I feel like it's like watching a sports channel, right? It's just like, it's easy. But here's the thing. What it tells me is that there's a significant number of Canadians who are getting an American perspective on COVID. And so part of it is the sharply divided partisan politics. Part of it is the tragedy that New York City went through. But I often wonder to what extent are their views, the Canadian viewers of CNN, to what extent are their political views and reaction informed by what's happening in the States as opposed to Canada? Earlier, we were talking about the importance of the regional differences within Canada in terms of dealing with COVID. But I think it's also important to realize that the COVID story is much different in Canada than it is in the United States. The primacy of the medical health officers, the credibility that most people seem to feel they have, the compliance level across the country, the fact that for a variety of reasons, we don't have people armed with rifles who are standing outside legislatures. So, you know, we do have to, I think, or I would suggest, acknowledge that same virus, two countries, two very different cultural reactions to that virus.
Mm. Another question about reporting. This comes from Leslie Evans Ogden. Reporting on a virus that is new to humans inherently comes with a lot of scientific uncertainty. What's your advice to journalists about conveying that uncertainty honestly and responsibly to audiences?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like we've done that. And by we, I don't mean just CBC. I would say the same thing for CTV and Global. Their coverage has been really strong as well. And I think, you know, Dr. Isaac Bogosh, the infectious disease specialist from Toronto, who gets way more airtime than I do, Dr. Saxinger in Alberta. We have seen these, you know, I got into a Twitter back and forth with some people a few weeks ago who were complaining about CBC's medical experts. And I said, well, we don't have medical experts. Like, we're using these doctors who are independent doctors working at various hospitals or universities across the country who are volunteering their time to us because they feel it's important to do. And I have loved, as both a journalist and a consumer of news, hearing these experts, many of whom I'd never heard of before, answer these questions. So to answer the question from that you got there, I think that it's important for us to go to the experts. It's been easy on this story, you know, unlike, let's say, the aftermath of terrorism or a story about the economy, where you have to be so careful about the ideology, perhaps, of a so-called expert. Here, when it comes to infectious disease specialists, it's not ideology, right? It's science. And we've given them a platform. Governments have, but so too have media. And I feel like I feel really well informed, and I hope other people do too.
It's interesting because we have been pre-COVID arriving at a point where to be an expert was so many people would deride the idea of an expert or the need to, and you've seen this back and forth on Twitter too, I'm sure, the need to always have an opposing opinion to be fair. But in the terms of scientific coverage, the importance of putting experts front and center, including government bureaucrats, people from the bureaucracy of, for example, the public health departments, and listening to what they say, it's brought us to a different place in our view, I think, of experts, of science, and of the people working behind the scenes in governments.
Yeah, you know, it's when you think about the influence Bonnie Henry has, Dr. Bonnie Henry has in BC, it's not a cult of personality, right? It's a cult of science, and it's a cult of compassion. Like she's also, you see her compassion shining through day to day. And it's not the tyranny of science, right? It's all out there. Like if you question what Dr. Isaac Bogosh is saying, you can find the sources that he's relying on. His Twitter, I follow him on Twitter, and the number of people who follow him on Twitter has soared, as it should. And when I see him retweet an article, you know how so many people are careful on Twitter to say a retweet is not an endorsement, but certainly when he retweets an article, it means that he as an expert feels it's worth passing on. I've read medical, you know, one of the things I've learned, Anna Maria, and I'm sure you have as well, when I started out, I used to think if I didn't understand something that an expert was describing, I would think it was me. And then over time, I realized that anything can be explained. You know, rocket science can be explained. Infectious diseases can be explained. Good experts are able to explain it in a way that those of us who are lay people will understand. And so, you know, it's all out there, right? It's a couple of clicks away. And having said that, actually, isn't it interesting that at a time when real information is readily available, widely available, there's still some bad information and some like malicious misinformation that still is managing to see the light of day. Like you'd think it would be absolutely drowned out by the good information, but not entirely.
Well, there are a couple of questions from people asking you how you sort through that.
Well, I mean, I do think that we can rely on the experts, right? And I mean, I don't do it uncritically, and I would be, and I got to say, listen, I've seen some doctors answering questions outside of their area of expertise, and that already has my antenna kind of finely tuned, and it's like, okay, you know, you're not that kind of doctor. And then I listen very critically to what they have to say. But I've become such a fan of the infectious disease specialists. Like this is their time. This is in their wheelhouse. And I can say that I've yet to hear an infectious disease specialist. These are the ones that I've watched in Canada on various media. And there may well be an exception that I haven't seen, but I'm critical to the point of being cynical, to the point of annoying the people in my life sometimes, because when I see stuff on TV or listen on the radio, I'm very quick to say, wait a second, you know, is that really true? Or what's the basis of that? And it can be really annoying for people who are around me. But I got to say on this story, the infectious disease specialists, I feel like so far I've been able to rely on their interpretation. And so that helps me sort through things.
I got a question from a journalism student from Naira Ahmed, who writes, do you think schools should teach how to continue through challenging times like these, journalism schools?
Say that again?
Do you think journalism schools should be teaching how to continue through challenging times like this?
You know, I have to say, maybe I don't fully understand.
I think what she's asking is, do you think, I'm going to have to paraphrase it here because as I read it, as a journalism student, do you think schools should teach how to continue through challenging times like these? So is there a lesson for journalism students as we look at this.
I mean,
kind of a living, breathing lesson, isn't it?
I guess it is, and I apologize for maybe not fully understanding the question, but you know, there's a lot about journalism, and I think this is true of all of kind of artsy things, but actually even sciences, I'm sure in medicine it's the same kind of thing. They're the nuts and bolts of it, right? There's like, okay, we expect you to make these phone calls, and then you have to get the clips, and then you have to write the story, and it has to be clear. And then there's the sort of softer stuff. How do you deal with, you know, I can remember a few years ago sitting in this newsroom during a mass shooting, and we went through the story, and at the end of the day, a couple of the younger journalists came up and said, like, that really was not what I was expecting. And I said, well, what did you mean? And they just talked about how, even though we were here and the shooting happened many, many kilometers away, like well outside of British Columbia, even being here, doing the coverage, watching the clips, knowing what we were talking about, it was very grueling for some people. COVID-19 has been grueling in a different way, right? And again, there's that word, Anna Maria, unprecedented. Never have we had this story that's gone on for so long, that's affected so many lives, that's included deaths, many deaths, too many. Can journalism schools teach that? You and I are the wrong people to ask, because I didn't go, and I don't think you went to journalism school, so I'm not sure. But you know, journalists need to be resilient, they need to be curious, they need to be adaptable, and they need to be able to cover, whether it's a mundane story down the street or 9/11, figure out emotionally how to deal with that.
Ian, we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks for all your thoughts on this. It's nice to see you, and nice to hear what you're thinking.
Yeah, nice to see you, Anna Maria.
Ian Hanna-Mansing, thank you everyone for watching and for sending your questions. As usual, I didn't get through them all, and I apologize for that. We have a great lineup for the rest of the season. May 21st, Chantelle Hébert will join me. She's the political commentator for the Toronto Star and the At Issue panel for CBC's The National. She's going to talk about Canadian leadership and the response to COVID-19 and what she's seeing in politics and what she's watching for. On May 28th, I'll be joined by Heather Scofield, the economics columnist with the Toronto Star. She'll be talking about our new economic reality and covering that and what she's asking already. And June 4th, we're pleased to invite Susan B. Glasser to this panel. The Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker has been on this a lot. If you can follow what she's been writing. She's been watching President Trump's response to all of this and tracking all of it, and she will share her thoughts on U.S. politics and the pandemic. You can view details and register for these webcasts on the CJF website, and we hope you join us for those as well. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. See you next time. Thanks.